Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. Happy to have you with us. But first, I want to tell you about one of the sponsors we have here on the show. The NFL draft is one of the most anticipated days of any football fan's calendar, and that also means fantasy football season is not too far behind. DynastySportsEmpire.com is going to change the way you play fantasy football. DSE offers fantasy football gamers of all skill levels an opportunity to draft and retain your well-maintained rosters and players for their entire NFL career. Highlighted with large rosters, high-scoring games, easy payouts, and an amazing online community, DSE has everything you would want in a challenging online experience. Please visit them online today at DynastySportsEmpire.com. That's DynastySportsEmpire.com. And check out all the amazing upcoming formats for this upcoming fantasy football season. Go check them out. We got a great episode for you today, so let's get to it.
Hey, everybody out there. This is Charlie Hewn, lead singer of Foghat, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hello, everybody. Welcome on back to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. Hello, hello, hello from hot, sweaty New Jersey, and I'm just assuming hot and sweaty Georgia.
Well, we're right by good old, what's that hurricane's name? Edsel?
I don't know.
Ezel? I don't know, but we're getting a lot of precipitation through the whole weekend.
Oh.
So we're not as bad as we usually are now. Basically, Georgia's been a lot cooler than you guys up there. I know you hit 100 about a week ago or something like that.
Yeah, and it's pretty cool when you choose like a job outside of, you know, making ranking in millions of dollars here on the podcast that involves being on the turf all day long in 100-degree weather. That's usually a smart choice.
Have you petitioned the school for the indoor facility for your soccer team, Scott?
No, we are outside and boiling, if you will. I'm like, come home, take a shower, and still kind of hot. Like, I'm hot right now, and it's been like 8 hours since I've been home.
I mean, there's no way you could just like call up like Sony to say, hey, sponsor my middle school soccer team's indoor stadium so we can train, and then, you know, the big Sony patches come out during every game, you know, little patch that says what school you go to.
Unfortunately, no. Being a lonely soccer coach is not I don't have a lot of pull, if you will, among the community of players and the community of sponsorships.
I feel you should find more indoor air-conditioned sports, Scotty.
Oh,
maybe like
air-conditioned soccer is very common.
Yeah, I'm like, even you can think outside the box. Like, maybe you can do indoor air conditioning fishing.
Now you're talking. Now you're going to have to explain to me how that's going to work.
Well, I mean, obviously, with the deal with Sony, you'll get money so you can pay some dude to just, like, get, like, 1,000 trout and throw it into a big, like, I don't know. Can they fit in a lobster tank?
So essentially, a biosphere, but just for my air conditioned fish tournament.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you want, I mean, I know you got a canoe. You can put your canoe on top of the lobster tank and act like you're, you know, rowing and trying to find the fish.
Yeah. So I mean, a couple of weeks ago, we had his name is escaping me.
Chris Van Vliet.
No, not Chris Van Vliet. Dr. Mark Nelson on the show.
Well, Chris Van Vliet, he does professional fishing. That's why I brought up his name.
Oh, okay. We're just going to bring Chris Van Vliet from Canada in to help me out with my air-conditioned fishing league.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds... I mean, two fellow podcasters together making this indoor sports league. I mean, I think it'll take off. And I mean...
What if instead it wasn't necessarily indoor, but it was some kind of cubicle type thing you can place upon your kayak or your boat that was air conditioned.
So you're saying like you had to like row with an entire building on top of you, for lack of a better term.
I mean, not a building, but I'm thinking more like a, almost like a tent that is air conditioned, but and just like your arms are hanging out with the fishing pole.
Ooh, so you're kind of looking like a robot there.
Correct,
you know?
Correct.
Your oars outside the cubicle, rowing. Meanwhile, you're like, ah, this is so cool. And you already got the fish inside of the lobster tank, so you're set there.
I mean, I feel like some people might say that one of the criticisms is taking the great outdoors out of the great outdoors part of the sport, but I got to be cold.
Yeah, I got to be honest. The outdoors, not that great. Like, dude, that six-month patch, you know, where the sun says, you know what, I'm going to stay out here? I'm like, no. I wanted it to be cloudy. I wanted it to be snowy. I want to put on my hoodie. I don't want any of this tanning stuff, okay? I'm getting a little sick of this world.
Well, anyway, welcome to our stupidity that we like to call Verbal Shenanigans as we roll on to, Mike, we're getting closer to 400 episodes. And, Mike, the fandom is growing. The, you know, a couple weeks ago, I think we mentioned the last three or four casts, we had opera singer from Britain's Got Talent, Jonathan Antoine, on, and we opened up this porthole, this wormhole of fandom that we did not know existed called the Fantwans. And now that's, what, three or four episodes ago, and we are still, Mike, getting tweets about our episode, getting retweets and everything, so much so that they've now followed the show, and you suggested that our followers be called the Verbalian. Still a little, doesn't roll quite off the tongue yet, but we have someone out there claiming to be Verbalian number one.
Yep, she put out there her suggestion of the Shenanigang, but I still feel my Verbalian thing will be the one that takes off. I think you can really get some nice custom t-shirts with like different weird alien heads. Like, I just imagine like a green and yellow shirt with Alf on it, giving a thumbs up.
Now, longtime listener of the podcast, Dom, our friend Dom Bagnano, who's actually been on the podcast a long time ago, sent me a message. He said, FYI, forget Verbalians. Your following will always be the Shenanigang. So, Mike, I think you have warring, battling Verbal Shenanigans groups going on right now.
Not real fans will be Verbalians. I'm sorry. Like, I will actually attack our fan base who tried to call themselves the Shenanigang.
So, like so you're going against our long time. You're going out with the old, in with the new, if you will.
But I've been here long enough to realize when I see that spotlight showing up, Scott, and that spotlight is clearly on Verbalians. And that fan base is going to go nuts, you know. That's going to be the group that's just going to, like, pick us up and bring us into the next century.
So what you're saying is as the Verbalians grow and the Shenanigang and angers, I'm thinking a Netflix movie, you know, kind of like a Sharks vs. Jets situation, you know, gang warfare, kind of very violent, rated R type film produced by us. I don't know. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I see kind of like the Verbalians wearing yellow on green and the Shenanigang wearing green on yellow. And I just see this like intense war on the streets where everybody's like, why is everybody wearing those ugly colors?
You think our listeners think we do a lot of drugs before these these episodes?
I wish they'd offer us some. I mean, hey, if you want a free t-shirt, send your drugs to Verbal Shenanigans.
No. Please send them to Mike Berlew. no. All of a sudden, I'm going to have like these weird, sketchy Amazon boxes showing up to the house. And like, oh, did I order socks? Oh, no, it's cocaine again for the third time this week.
You, man, yeah, I was waiting for like some hardware to come in, and it was heroin. I'm like, well, All right. I mean, I guess my weekend's going in a different direction today.
I mean, I can't waste it. Someone sent it to me. It's a gift.
Yeah. It'd be rude if you flush it down the toilet. I mean, I don't even know. I mean, I guess cocaine will naturally go down the toilet. I've never put other drugs down there to see if it'll go. I mean, any pills are going to float. So
you've never done a drug flushing experiment in your house?
No. I feel like pills will just float, and then I got to do stuff like put toilet paper on top of the pills so we'll take it down.
So you've never gone out to the streets, you know, in a rundown area, bought like a hell of a lot of drugs, like with a lot of money, and been like, all right, let's see what fits down the toilet.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a good way to waste $8,000, you know, just like...
I feel we've learned that you have this thing for like pouring water on ice in the sink, and like you kind of got a weird thing about it. I feel like this might be the next step up from that. Like, ooh, how much Oxycontin can I fit down the pipes, you know?
Yeah, it's going to be really awkward when I laugh at the cops, haha, you'll never catch me, and then they'll be like, you know, you got a septic tank, right?
Yeah.
We can kind of open that thing up, you know that?
Do you actually have a septic tank?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Actually, sewers are kind of rare in Georgia down here.
Really?
Most of the things are just septic tanks for like at least anything I've looked at down here. And I even talking to like my brother and my dad and all, that's pretty much a common thing down
I've always
here.
Heard septic tanks were a pain in the ass, no pun intended. But I've always heard they're very touchy. You got to be on top of them.
I do know, like, when I remember when I was in between places and I was living with my brother.
You lived in a septic tank?
No. But living at my brother's, he had, like, issues where, like, I could only do laundry a certain day because his septic tank would overflow and then the back would just smell like sewage and all. That was a whole thing with his ex. Where like she hated that I was there, even though it was pain to be there. So she would purposely do laundry on my laundry day just to say, ha ha, you can't do laundry.
Epic battles going on in that household.
The former sister-in-law, she's a touchy subject with the family. I mean,
she's currently in the septic tank, guys. She's not.
I think I kind of talked to you last week about that wedding,
right,
where it was kind of awkward where the two sides of the families didn't want to talk. But needless to say, like, I had to talk to my brother to get my laundry privileges when you're paying like a few hundred dollars a month. Mm-hmm. And then she got ticked off. And then when I moved out, she says, I can't wait for you to move out. And then I kind of did some things to her stuff after I left that I didn't tell her, but I know in the end I got a smile on my face.
Did some things too. You're just going to leave us on this. You're going to give us this little breadcrumb. Like, are we talking you took a dump in her sock drawer or?
Well, let me see all the things that I did. Well, one thing I loved doing was when she was playing that game with the laundry. Since I have long arms, I would unplug the washer and dryer. And she's a 4'11", 200-something woman, so her ability to get back there was very hard to do. So I kind of enjoyed doing that a couple times. Let's see. I do remember I found a jar of mayonnaise, and I opened it, and I put it on the top shelf to make sure it was somewhere where it's going to cook, but at the same time, not easily to be seen. I took a couple of packs of her cigarettes, with my overall goal being to put them back one day. Like, my plan was, I guess it's a thing where you keep them in the fridge or freezer to keep them fresh. I don't know.
No idea.
But my plan was basically to just take them and then, like, years down the road, like, sneak it in and just kind of see the reaction on that. But in the end, I just stole cigarettes in that scenario. poured half a bottle of Tabasco in her tomato sauce that only she likes, so I didn't punish the rest of my family. Toothbrush into the toilet. That's a good one.
Wow. There's some devious stuff here. It started off with just some height things. Now we're getting toothbrush in the toilet. This is like some TBS kind of like movie that you would watch.
Yeah, and I think like she used to be a school bus driver, so I think I put like a bottle of urine in her garbage can in the school bus. I think that's all I did, but if anything pops up, we'll bring it back up.
This is very devious of you. I was thinking like you're gonna be like, oh yeah, she's a school bus driver, so I cut the brakes on the bus. Like it seemed like the stories were escalating here, and now you're just putting, now you're putting bottles
murdered
of pee in
her third cousin. Yeah. I mean, she talked to him a little bit, so it wasn't that devastating. But I made my point.
Wow. Well, anyway, I want to start quickly. Well, I guess we already started, but I want to make a public address statement to middle-aged white women. Middle-aged white women, if you are listening, which you could be listening, please, if you're going to come to a comedy show, don't. No. Okay. Don't. If you're going to come to a comedy show and you're like, you literally yell out at one of the comics after they're trying to quiet you down, it's my thing. I yell out. Please don't ever come to a comedy show ever again. I had mentioned on the show, I had a couple doozies in a row. I had a torrential downpour a couple weeks ago. I had 7 people the other night with Bob Levy. Then I had this show for this new promoter I was working for down in kind of your old stomping ground down towards Bristol, Pennsylvania.
Okay,
not,
all right,
yeah,
know
not,
that area,
not too far at a brewery there. And brewery's nice. Now I walk in. Now this is for a new promoter and super nice guy. And I thought all the comics on the show were very good. I thought everyone was a good joke writer. But I walk in, and the setup is so strange. The setup, you walk into the brewery, and I'm like, where's the comedy at? And I'm thinking, I see an upstairs. And then I'm like, there's people sitting upstairs, and there's people sitting downstairs. I'm like, where's the comedy? And I look up, probably about 20 feet. And the mic is set up like on the ledge of like a above a stairwell with like a railing in front. So it's basically the people directly in front of you. You were speaking down like 25 feet down to the audience. And then if you look to the left, then there was like a group of like 25 people on the left hand side. So really anywhere in your direct line of view, you don't see anybody. You literally have to look over a railing to try to talk to the crowd.
Ooh, I kind of like that, the hidden audience thing. So you almost got a real – it gets rid of the crowd work comedians that they can't stand half the time. Like the ones that like never wrote an ounce of material in their lives, and they immediately they take the mic to go, look at this weird shirt. It's just like, oh, God.
So no. So you like the element of not being able to see the whole half of audience.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's kind of like the dating game, but with comedy.
Right.
It's like the you don't know what the audience look like or whatever, but you're just trying to gauge from what you hear on the other side of the wall, and maybe you'll make a match one day where it's like, oh, you were the one in seat 3. Great. You'll buy my CD.
Yeah. So I was closing that show. So I was there for, the whole 90 minutes of the show. From minute 1. To minute 90, this table of drunk white women decided to just literally talk the entire time. Like, what are you ordering? Are you getting a burger? Like, you could hear everything. And then not only did they talk, they decided to bring their own, like, bags of chips and Doritos. Because, so now picture comedy. What goes better than talking people with crinkly bags of chips as the comics are trying to talk?
Yeah, when I do my punchline, I always found the jokes hit better when I can hear the crunching of Doritos. I find
you did.
Just on its own, you know, it's not, you know, it was good. I mean, not the greatest. I mean, I made my own, but when somebody goes, man, am I hearing Cool Ranch? Then they're getting into the show.
So that's why you actually quit. You weren't finding enough chip-laden audiences.
The thing was, Doritos discontinued my favorite flavor, and I'm like, well, if they're giving up, I'm giving up a comedy.
You're like, how am I supposed to tell jokes without the crunching of sour cream and onion chips?
Yeah, right. That was classic.
Yeah.
Come on.
So that's going on. I go up. I mean, a bunch of the comics addressed him. They'd stop for maybe 3-4 minutes. I go up, and I'm just like, you know, guys, like the pandemic, it's amazing how much it's changed our lives forever. Like, pre-pandemic at comedy shows, you're supposed to put your phone away and shut the hell up. And I'm like, apparently, after the pandemic, that is out the window. You know, and they shut up for 5 minutes and it's right back. They're just talking. And yeah, one girl was literally leaning against an electrical box. And I was like, ma'am, please pour your beer on that electrical box. Just please do it. And like, just telling them over and over again, like, I was like, oh, you know, no big deal. The other 50 people that paid, they don't need to hear anything. It's all about you guys. It's all about your little table. And I've been through I've had the talking hecklers before. I've only closed X amount of shows in my life, and I've never seen the talking go the whole show, you know. And there's no real kind of security or whatever at a brewery, so they're not going to boot them out. But usually the talking, like a couple weeks ago, or a month ago, I had our first Tap House show back, and the talking was the first 15 minutes or so. And I gave them a pass because people forgot how to go out. But it stopped, and the show was great by the end. This never stopped. And it was far away. You know, it was like an hour and 25-minute drive-ish. Just kind of like a miserable experience. So I had like 3 duds in a row. And then finally, we had a Tap House the other night, and it was phenomenal. And the audience was there at a party. Like, the comics on the show sold a ton of merch. So thank you, Tap House 15, for once again being my old reliable friend and providing a good audience. But holy crap, I was ready to quit. It's very hard, like, leaving your kid and wife. Like, when your wife already is like, you got a show where? I'm like, yeah, you know, Bristol, Pennsylvania. Okay, and then you go, and it's just a dud, and you drive back like, oh man, I kind of feel like crap, you know.
Yeah, wife sees you walk through the door. Yeah, she said his first word, but how is Bristol, PA?
Yeah. Like when I drove there, the place next to it was a DVD and like adult toy store, and it was like, ooh. DVD. Use DVDs exchange, like, you could, like, first off, I didn't know anybody buys DVDs anymore.
I'm not sure those kind of DVDs you want to exchange. I mean, I'm fairly confident you don't want to touch those things without a rubber glove on your hand.
Yeah, there. gross. But anyway, comedy is. I feel like people are easing back into society. Like, maybe they should start with music, where they're allowed to talk and just kind of do whatever they want and work their way up to deaf poetry and comedy and things that require attention. Not for them.
We need an obedience ladder to get the communities back. And it's like, hey, can I go to a comedy show? And you got to present your card. And it's like, ooh, no, you're at level 2. I'm sorry. You have to go to a school play right now.
Don't get tossed out of the middle school play, and you can come to the comedy show.
Yep. Once they give you your sticker, you're a little step closer, you know, maybe a little league game. I don't know and all, but a couple weeks from now, you can come back to Tap House, my friend.
It's funny because it actually spurred me. I'm going to put they're going to be like funny for the most part, and also like with our social media things on the bottom, but I want to put little cards on tables like how to behave at a comedy show. You know, like, if you're offended, please go seat yourself in the VIP section in the parking lot. Like, number 2, you know, like all these little things, like, please throw your phones out, no texting, no Tindering, no, you know, and kind of, I want to put these on the tables, and then, like, you know, if you like the show, please follow, blah, 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 you know, but I don't know, man. It was a week or two of gigs that made me definitely question what the hell
I'm doing with my life here. But
Scott, I'm telling you, outdoor comedy, you went indoors and you felt the pain.
You did say that. You did say, I am the new outdoor comedy guy.
Yeah, so. I mean, the comedy gods know. They see you walk into a building and they're like, he can't handle a roof. Hell no. Get that man out of there.
Yeah, yeah. But whatever. I feel like our guests will understand what a bad audience feels like. I mean, it's time to get to our guests. We got a very cool one today. I guess this guy has probably dealt with every kind of audience because he's been playing music for basically like 50-something plus years. And so we have on the show a guy by the name of Charlie Hune, who you may know him from a little man playing guitar in a little band with a guy named Ted Nugent. You may know him from Humble Pie, or you may know him from this small band that's been playing for the last 50-plus years. In fact, they're releasing a 50th anniversary album by the name of Foghat, if you play Jammed on Slow Ride in your car. So Charlie took over about 20 years ago as the frontman and guitarist, and Charlie is an awesome guy, and we're excited to get Charlie on the show. So without further ado, here is Charlie Hune. So Charlie, first off, thanks for giving us a few minutes here on the show. We really appreciate the time.
Sure. Pleasure's all mine.
Yeah. So where are you at these days?
I'm in Florida, just north of Orlando. How about you?
I'm in Jersey, and Mike over there is in Georgia.
Douglasville, Georgia.
Yeah. So we're a little.
Oh, okay.
We're a little spread out. Mike left me years ago to move to the South, so he didn't like me anymore.
Best decision I ever made, Scotty. Yeah. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, Charlie, I guess I'll start. It's, you know, it's pretty amazing that, you know, you look at Foghat, and they're coming up on 50 years of making music, and you're already, which I think is just a feat on its own, you're already 20 years, 21 years in the band. Is that like hard to even process?
Exactly, man. Well, every day it hits me, you know? And it's funny when Roger makes comments like, you've been in the band longer than the original band was together.
Yeah.
Yep. it's a pleasure, man. It's a real honor, you know, and it's been weird not playing all the time, you know. It's like, be careful what you wish for.
Right.
You know, you're out there playing all the time, and you just want to stay home sometimes, and then all of a sudden, boom, you're home all the time, and then you go, wait a minute, you know, this is, something's wrong here.
Right. Go ahead, Mike.
But out
of curiosity, I mean, when you're in a band that's been around for 50 years and all, if anybody just yells and all, can you play this obscure song? Can you know all the songs in the catalog by heart?
Oh, man. Well, personally, no. And, you know, it doesn't take long to learn them, you know, but because they're basically three chords anyway, you know.
Right.
Anything with more than three chords would be, you know, held with a certain amount of suspicion. But, you know, as far as playing every song in the catalog, wow, that's quite an ordeal. Because those guys were prolific writers.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, when you're talking that much music and you're talking so many generations, you find now that, like, I guess through, you know, through streaming and through services like Spotify and iTunes, that you guys are still able to kind of just bring new generations of fans along. Do you find that to be an advantage for the band?
Yeah, you know, it kind of gives it the stamp of timeless music.
Right.
Which is such an honor because, you know, it's obvious that, you know, something great was going on back in the day, and for it to still persist and bring over new young listeners, fans, whatever, it's just a super honor, and it gives it that timeless feeling, you know,
mm-hmm.
qualifying up there with the big boys.
out of curiosity, like, being in for music as long as you have, do you have like a one set, like, this is my baby kind of equipment? Or are you the kind of person that just changes every year and gets comfortable with a new piece of new guitar? Well, what's your style?
Well, I'm pretty straightforward, you know, just the Marshall 100 watt, you know, JCM 900 and straight into the amp from the Les Paul, or I have a Diamond guitar endorsement, and they're really nice sounding and playing also. But yeah, I just use a couple of pedals and just go for that straight, you know, simple hard rock guitar sound.
Yeah.
Now Brian on the other hand has effects that, you know, like rack mount effects that help him get his sound, but I've always, you know, stuck with it just basic.
Now when you joined the band, were you a fan of Foghat before you got in the band, or was it just something that there was an opening and you just went for it?
Actually, I was always a fan of the band ever since the first album came out, and I was in college when that came out. I'll never forget listening to it over and over, you know, along with Dark Side of the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
and all my friends too, you know, because I Just Want to Make Love to You just popped, you know, it just slammed, and it's such a great mix, and they played it so well, and the interpretation of the old blues songs is so cool that it just stands by itself, you know, and so but as far as, I never saw the band until 98 when I was in Humble Pie with Jerry Shirley, and we opened up for them at a outdoor show in Toledo, Ohio, and I was so honored to see the band. It was the original band too, because Tony Stevens and Dave, Rod, and Raj, and I went up and chatted with them all. It was so cool seeing the band because I'd never seen them before. It was just one of those weird things, you know?
Yeah. So is that intimidating, stepping into like an audition or like joining those guys on stage for the first time?
You know, Dave and Raj, not patting myself on the back, but they both really thought I did a great job, you know, doing the Stevie Marriott thing, and it was always an honor to do that too, you know, but, they got a bunch of, audition tapes, and you know, they know all kinds of people, and you know, Dave wasn't doing too well, but he gave the thumbs up to get me in the band, you know, and told Raj to, you know, continue on, and so Raj just gave me a call, you know, and that was pretty cool. Lucky.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, there was a story too. I could tell you this brief story. I had a day job at the time working at Ford. And on my way to my job in the morning, 6 a.m., this guy that I worked with said, "Did you hear Lonesome Dave passed away?" And I'm like, "You're kidding me. No way." And so then he pointed his finger at me, and I went, "Oh, yeah, sure," you know. And the next day, Roger called.
Wow.
That was, yeah. It was like this guy was clairvoyant or something. But it's a total honor, you know.
That's awesome.
Hmm. Kind of piggybacking off of Scott's question, he talked about Foghat. Let's go to like one of your original big breaks, you know, when you're auditioning for Ted Nugent. Is you like in your 20s? Like, what's this scene like? 27. Is he like just staring at you? Is he like monitoring everything you do? Do you have to play a riff and then like shoot a deer afterwards to impress him?
Yeah, I was gonna ask also, like, does after being with Nugent, does everybody just seem like calm and cool to you?
Yeah, you know, it's exactly, you know, because Ted was always on stage, still is, you know. We talked and we got along great. You know, I really respect the guy. And talk about a prolific songwriter. You know, he calls me up at least every 6 months and goes, God, I've got the best songs now, man. You won't believe it. I just can't stand myself. I'm so fucking great. I go, yeah, Ted, I know. But, yeah, you know, that audition was fun. It took like 9 months. And I actually got pissed off at him about 6 months in waiting for the audition, you know, and I yelled at him on the phone. And I guess he liked that. He likes it when people, you know, give him shit. So
you're saying that Ted Nugent likes confrontation? No way.
Yeah. Yeah, I knew I was telling you something new, right? Yeah, boy. So, you know, that was kind of interesting. But, yeah, the audition happened, and we didn't have to shoot any guns or anything. You know, it was just straight music. And a friend of mine in Memphis still has the audition tape. It was done at Al Malley's in Ann Arbor. Every now and then he'll send me a snippet of, you know, Snakeskin Cowboys or something like that, you know. It's like, oh, my God, I forgot all about that.
Yeah.
But it was a great time.
Yeah, I mean, when you've been playing music for as long as you, do you find that you forget more than you remember? Like, do people bring things up? Like, oh yeah, like I forgot.
Well,
I did
yeah,
that.
You know, it's interesting. And Raj is the same way. You know, even the 20 years I've been with Raj, I'll remind him of stuff, and he'll go, "I did. I said that." Yeah. So yeah, dude, don't you remember? But yeah, you know, I guess it does get fun to recall things, you know, that you can't remember everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but
Mike you know. And I have had so this pandemic year has been really interesting, especially for the podcast, because we've had so many like really awesome musicians on that were basically, and actors and things like that, where that were basically put to a standstill for about a year. You know, and some of them really took the time, the downtime, and they seemed to, it actually motivated them to create new music or try a new project. And then a couple of them seemed like it was, you know, almost like the death blow. So I'm curious, like, how you handled the pandemic. Was it good for you as far as being creative, or was it definitely like a bump in the road for you?
Well, it was a bump in the road, and I've been thinking about retiring on and off, you know, just to do it, and then all of a sudden, boom, you're slammed into, you know, forced retirement, temporary, but, you know, it's like, it was a challenge in that, you know, I didn't have my day job anymore, and so it's like, okay, well, what do I do now? And, you know, I write every now and then, no big deal, but it was basically like a scary moment, because I didn't know if I was going to get the virus. I didn't know I couldn't get unemployment because I didn't work in Florida, and then there were all kinds of changes that I had that I was forced into. But basically, I didn't mind staying home. You know, I started getting lazy almost. But yeah, it's good to, you know, get that show every 3 months. And you know, I managed to get a couple in over the past year, and you know, it all comes back. It's so much fun, you know, and so nice to get out and play in front of people again.
Yeah, like, so give us a little insight. So the band comes back together. You guys are celebrating 50 years, which is just incredible. What is it like the vibes as far as like getting together and playing music again? Is it like, do you keep in touch with these guys all the time, or do you just kind of come together when it's time to tune up for the road or record? What is the vibe like?
Well, you know, it's a professional vibe, because everybody's such great musicians. It's so wonderful to, when you finally get together, to hear that magic come out in the instruments and how it all you know, sinks. And so we stay in touch, you know, because we're all down here in Florida. Roger has a place, you know, real close to me, actually. And also he's on Long Island, as you know. But yeah, we stay in touch, you know, through Facebook, or just, you know, Linda, the manager, is Roger's wife, and she's, you know, always saying, hey, why don't we do this? Why don't we do that? And so we're always in touch and stuff. But it's really great to get together to make the music. And, you know, we had a private show back in April, and that worked out great. And it was so much fun getting together and playing again. And, you know, Roger has been kind of hampered with some physical ailments, like he has hand issues or toe issues. And, you know, there were times when he almost couldn't play, like his toe was hurting so badly. And and now he's doing the platelet therapy, and it's working great. So thank goodness. You know, I mean, he was so bad he almost couldn't play last year.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
It was like, oh boy, you know. But yeah, we stay in touch, and it's just best, you know, when we're all strapping the guitars on and going for it.
That's awesome.
Hey, your career has went through many decades, so many big things. I mean, we didn't even like talk about Humble Pie. I'm just kind of curious, was there any like small projects where you almost, you don't get enough talk about that you, that's like near and dear to your heart, like a Victory, No Mercy, Cirrus, any of those bands?
Wow. Now you're really bringing back some memories.
Charlie actually forgot about all those, Mike, just until you put them out
there. Yeah, exactly.
I wasn't in that. Oh, wait.
Right. Was that me? No. Yeah, the other projects, you know, I really enjoyed Victory because I really had to work a lot at writing. The guys would all write the music, and I would either write a full complete song, or I would have to write the melody and the lyrics and all that. And so I worked hard at that. And, you know, it didn't really take off that well. Although we were selling out 1,000-seaters in Germany back in 87. Yet as soon as I left, I ended up having a hit song. Wait a minute. Can I join back in? But anyway, yeah, working with Gary Moore was so cool because that guy was just prolific as hell. And it was just amazing. He made everything look so easy. And his brilliance on guitar. And plus, I got to play Greeny, which was cool. But he was so prolific at writing that it spurred your creativity and it made it easier for you to write. And we collaborated and you know, put together a couple albums. And it was just a great experience being with a master like that, you know?
Yeah.
But that's funny. You have in your notes, Cirrus. Oh my goodness, you know. But you forgot Vic Amato and Company. You know, that was my big cover band in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
But, right.
You know, Vic was a old high school friend, and we're still great friends. And he was a really good drummer. And we just did covers. You know, we did a couple of originals, but. Yeah, Ted came in to see us, and it was an honor that he came to see me, and he asked if he could sit in and jam, and I said no. He went, okay. But, you know, then he said, you know, that David Bowie song, he didn't sound like David Bowie, and I went, oh, oops. But, yeah, you know, it's just weird the things you do in life, and then you look back and you go, I did that?
Yeah, yeah. But,
you know, a lot of it was just trying to stay busy and keep working, you know, and just the love of the music, so.
Yeah, well, let's segue into you're clearly staying busy. You guys are releasing 8 Days on the Road, and there's – you're going for a lot longer than 8 days on the road with a tour coming up. It looks like it starts on Saturday, July 17th. And it looks like you guys got dates all the way through October of next year, as far as some dates on the calendar. But it's a pretty significant tour. are you? You got to be like chomping at the bit after, you know, after a year of COVID, and now you guys have something amazing to celebrate. So tell us about the album and the tour.
Okay, sure. You know, we had a. In fact, I have my old schedule that's over a year old now. That everything got canceled or postponed, and right. So most of these shows are postponements. And new shows are coming in all the time, you know, not like they used to. But we have a great agency that, you know, these guys are just on top of everything. But, yeah, we're looking forward to getting together and getting back out there and working regularly, you know, because the fun thing about that is after you get a couple, three shows under your belt, then it's like so much fun because you're like all tuned up. You're in shape, and you can, you know, it's almost like muscle memory. So the shows just keep getting better and better and better. And when I'm kind of like a perfectionist, but you know, it's just more amazing when you get that feeling that you're moving to another level with a performance. It's real satisfying. So I'm looking forward to that. And as far as the live CD and DVD, we're getting really good reaction to it. It's not officially coming out until next month, but
right.
you know, it's a great live set that we did for about a year, and you know, it starts out. You know, bang, bang, you know, it hits them right in the face. And the crowds have been loving it. And playing in a club was so cool because you're right in, you know, face to face with the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gives you motivation and inspiration because people are so damn close to you. You just get the vibe.
Yeah. And so. Well, I had a question, like when you're, you know, you kind of made me think of it. When you're in a band that has 50 years worth of music and you have to put together a set list, like what is the process? Is it like, okay, let's put Slow Ride in there and then let's go to work and figure out the other like 15 songs? Like, because there's so much to choose from. How do you guys go about that?
Right. Well, Roger kind of has a plan or a... I noticed it early on anyway, that he, in fact, in the beginning, he didn't really want to make the set list, you know, and then he slowly took over, just like he never wanted to sing. And I said, okay, well, you're going to start singing. He goes, no, I'm not. And I said, yeah, you are. And so we gave him a mic, and then he started singing his real low parts and stuff, just goofing around because he's such a ham. But anyway, you know, he started taking it into his own of making the set list. And, you know, we always have to do Fool Love Slow, you know.
That's right.
the winning set ender sequence there. But in the beginning, the set and middle, we tried to have a strong start and like a little lull in the middle, like slow blues or something moody, then hit them again, bang, bang, bang at the end, you know. So we'll change up the songs every year. We'll get together in January and learn three or four new old songs or maybe write something and play something new. But basically Roger's been having a real good time writing the set, and it's like you see him acting like, oh yeah, I can do this, you know. It's like, oh yeah, I'm the only original member left.
Yeah,
I can do this, you know. Yeah, let me do it. I want to do it, you know.
And he wears the fog hat.
Yeah, he does. He does. He carries the flag, you know. And so I get a kick out of watching him, you know. And so he'll say, well, let's do this. And we all go, okay. And then we'll do it. And then we'll all say, oh, that didn't work, you know, or that works.
Yeah.
Okay. So, at any rate, It's pretty simple and basic, you know, but like you say, there are so many songs. That's why we try to bring one of the more obscure songs out every now and then, because audiences like to hear something fresh and different, and especially if you can pull an album track out and make it happen.
Right.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
It's good for you.
And with all the excitement coming on tour and everything, I'm just kind of curious, in your years of performing, has anybody, like a family member or a spouse, ever come up to you and say, you're getting too old for this music thing. You should really use that social sciences bachelor's degree to use.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. That reminds me of my father. You know, he said when I was 26, he said, you know, you don't want to be a 30-year-old teenager. And I thought to myself, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, right.
And then I got the Nugent job, and all of a sudden I'm making more money than he was. And you know, I never said anything or mentioned anything about it, but I guess it was okay with him, you know?
Yeah. So take that, Dad. He said it today.
Oh, God. Yeah. You know, he's a great guy, though. He's still alive. He's 97.
God bless. I mean, there must be something good. I mean, you don't look your age at all either. So there must be something in those Hume genes.
Bless you. Yeah, maybe the North Dakota genes. My parents were from North Dakota. Maybe they're like frozen genetics.
Dad, I'm going back on tour. I keep telling you, it's got a real job.
Exactly.
Charlie, first off, thank you so much for giving us the time. It's a real, real pleasure to talk to you, man. And it's so cool to see. It's so cool to see bands like yours still going. And I'm telling you right now, you're not allowed to retire, even though you mentioned it. So sorry.
Thanks. And it's really an honor to chat with you guys. You guys are really awesome. Give great interviews and ask great questions, and you're hilarious. It's a real pleasure for me.
Yeah, thanks so much. We appreciate that. So I guess my parting question to you is, if people want to check out Foghat or check out what you're up to, where they should go, and two, the main part of it is, you know, you've been playing music so long with some of the biggest names in the industry, and you've probably done shows from three people in a bar to hundreds of thousands of people, whatever it is. Is there like a show or a venue or a specific memory that like is the highest, like you hold in the highest regard after all these years? Like you're never going to beat that particular show.
Wow. A few of them come to mind, and they were back with Ted when like we would headline Day on the Green, Bill Graham's event, and there would be 88,000 people out there, and you just walk out on stage and there's this massive raw like that, and you just go, wow, so this is what it's like, you know. And so there are a couple of shows like that, you know, the Madison Square Garden, the Boston Gardens, you know, Arrowhead Stadium, Coliseum in LA. It's just, you know, that kind of stuff. But one that sticks out in my mind was in Philadelphia, I think Spectrum. And all of a sudden, Jim Pernod, our old Nugent stage manager, road manager guy, was hustling me out to the stage. And all of a sudden, this body lands on me. And it was a girl that jumped out of the stands. That, you know,
Jesus.
Like, oh my God, you know. It made me feel
Philly,
like I was in the Beatles.
Yeah.
I'm from Philly. They may have thrown that at you.
Yeah.
Gotta be honest.
They were like, all right, we're done booing Santa Claus. We're going to we're gonna throw bodies at Foghat at Nugent.
Oh God.
Charlie.
Yeah, so anyway, thanks again, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, man, and stay safe, and good luck with the tour and the album.
Okay, thanks, you guys. You take care.
All right, Mike. When you die, am I allowed to find a replacement?
Well, I'm a god, so I don't think that death thing.
You're a god now. You're a god. You just skipped over this weird fantasy where you had tons of fans and things like that, and now you're a god.
Well, I mean, I just had a feeling this morning I was a god. So, I mean, could be wrong, but
wait. So you woke up in the morning and you were like, you know what?
I feel pretty good.
I must be God. I am a God. So are you like God or are you just one of many?
No. That's like upper echelon.
That's next year.
I'm like into like the double A league of gods. You know, this. You know, whatever those people that follow like Tom Cruise's religion and stuff like that. I'm kind of like in that level. You know,
you're in the Scientology. God stage.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, we're not going to take you too seriously, but I guess we'll give you some respect and the benefit of the doubt.
I think this interaction with the fans over the last couple of weeks has really changed you. I think suddenly a man throws out Verbalion, someone tweets at you and says, hey, Pilgrim Mike, hey, I'm Verbalion number one. Suddenly you're waking up looking at yourself going, you know what? I am above a human. I am a god.
You know, I mean, you got to feel good about yourself, Scott, once in a while. You know, some people treat themselves to a good meal or have a cigar. I just say, you know what, Mikey? You're a god. Good for you.
All right. So considering you're a god now, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore.
No?
I can't do this anymore. This is the last episode. Considering you're a god now, so that means I die first. Are you going to replace me?
I mean, I guess I should, considering you had the board. I mean, I haven't even Googled
it. So this little $199 mixing board I have here is I'm the gatekeeper, basically, for the podcast because I have this thing.
I mean, I haven't Googled anything yet, so I don't know how much of a hassle it is to, like, get this stuff and hook it up. So, I mean.
Wait. So if I die, the podcast just ends because you don't want to go buy a mixing board.
Well, like I said, I mean, I got to see how the research goes. But if it starts going, you know, like I got to turn some knobs and plug in some stuff, I might go, bah.
So
I'm going to get into fishing.
So right now I have like 5 cables hooked up and one mixing board and a computer and a recorder. And that's just, you're like, you know what? Scott would want this to die.
Scott, that was a full sentence. I mean, I'm trying to chill here and everything, and that was a lot there. So, I mean.
So you know you could do, like, you don't even need a mixing board. You could do it on the computer if you really wanted to.
I should look that up or something. I don't know.
I also can't wait till we get a tweet. Hey, God, Mike. And then I'm literally shutting you out. I'm blocking you from everything. Social media, any emails, all of it's gone. As soon as we get a hey God Mike and you have some weird following where you're like the cult leader of the Verbalions, I'm done.
Scott, you're going to anger your God, so I'd be careful if I was you.
When we're podcasting like in a couple weeks and I see like strange women walking around your basement like asking you if you want a drink or you feel like you need more ice or fresh beer, it's over.
And I'm going to have my own fanboy. Now all these things about me being a fanboy, no more, Scott. I will possess one to take care of my needs if it gets too warm down here.
For those who don't know what we're talking about, I'd pose the question to Mike if he would take a... Put it this way. The last 15, 20 episodes, we've been, I think, losing our minds here. I had asked him if he would take a job with, I gave him X amount of salary, and his job was to just fan an old man 8 hours a day, but he gets paid like really, really well. So now he's saying he'll hire his own. So maybe you actually liked that idea.
I don't know. I figure at that status, it should be able to just come with it. I won't have to worry about a salary. I just figure somebody would be like, hey, when I get to the afterlife, that, you know, I'm going to get a little niche, you know. It's like, hey, remember me? I was fanboy number 7.
But for you're claiming you're a god. What what gives you the impression that you're, like, do you have any godlike tendencies? Like, are you noticing superpowers? Mm-hmm. Are you, like, what gives you the right to say that you're a god suddenly?
Stop calling me your god.
Charlie Manson also thought he was, like, a god.
Well, I'm, like, a god. I'm not telling people to kill themselves or kill people. I'm not that type of guy. No, I'm the cool, chilled, laid-back guy. I just woke up one day. I'm like, I'm feeling pretty good, you know. Legs are feeling good. Mm-hmm. No pain or anything.
I can't wait till you have minions, like, putting Tabasco sauce in, like, their hated sister-in-law's things, unplugging washers, putting urine bottles on buses. Like, you just have, like, a Fight Club-esque kind of scenario going on.
See, that I'll be down with. That will be some of the stuff that you join up on that. You know, that's the religious stuff you do with me, you know.
Wow. Yeah. So, yeah. If you are interested in co-hosting the podcast, please put in the title, Not a God. Send me some credentials and audio links to verbalshenaniganspodcast@gmail.com. And we'll force Mike out of here. And he'll be on the Pilgrim Mike God podcast on his own. And but maybe not on his own because he doesn't want to hook up a microphone.
Yeah, I'll probably do a podcast, but I won't actually, like, put it out or record it. I'll just, like, talk in front of a mic that's not plugged into anything for, like, 3 hours, and I'll just say it really loud so my neighbors can hear me, and just, if they'd like, oh, that was interesting, I would just yell at them, please subscribe.
Yeah, you've got this all figured out, but anyway, thank you, thank you, Charlie Hune, man. What a cool guest. And then it always sucks when they gotta leave, and then I gotta talk to you for like another half hour.
It comes with the territory. I don't know what to tell you. No, I mean, maybe you can go back to Bristol and talk to some middle aged women.
Now, as a god, do you have any kind of like, if someone was interested in following you, any kind of prayer or ritual they should be doing, or?
I'm laid back. I mean, do your thing, and I'll maybe once in a while I'll call you to hang or something like that.
No, like Our Father, nothing?
No, I don't need that much praise or anything. I mean, just, you know, be cool to others, and I guess listen to the podcast until Scott dies, in which case I can't put out any new episodes, but just live your life and be one with the burros. I don't know what to tell you.
So, now I'm wondering if this godlike status you're feeling is because you were recently caught on television and it's gone to your head.
Well, I mean, it wasn't that big of a deal. It was in the background, the shots, but it was kind of cool. I mean, that's the whole reason why I recorded
Now, why were you... Okay, we gotta break this down for the audience who's not... doesn't know what the hell we're talking about.
And you can share out my videos on the Verbal Shenanigans.
So you ran a race on Saturday or Sunday or whatever day it was.
It was Sunday. It was on the 4th of July. It's the Peachtree Road Race. It's actually considered like the biggest race deal in Georgia. Like, they also have like the Publix half marathons and marathons and stuff like that. But this is kind of like the real big tradition of Georgia, where like people come out and they, you know, it's like a whole day where they cheer on people running in the streets. A lot of the Olympians kind of use it as just like practice for qualifiers. We had Raphael Warnock, the senator, he ran it. The mayor of Atlanta, I forget her name, her last name is Buttons, she ran it. But they can. They usually get around 40,000-50,000 people to do it, but they broke it up. So 13,000 on Saturday, ran it 17,000 on Sunday.
I thought the biggest race in Georgia was the white race.
I mean, back in the day.
Okay, so you run this race, and the other day you posted a video, which I assume was the finish line.
Yeah, there was. We posted some pictures, a video. Yeah, there were two videos and one picture.
So there's a little news coverage kind of thing, like, hey, at the Peachtree, whatever race or whatever you call it. And you are on the left, suddenly just skipping to the finish line.
Yeah. Yeah. It was...
Care to explain, God Boy?
Yeah, so...
God Man, sorry. God Man, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, my prodigal son. It's one of those, you're at the end of the race. A lot of people cheering, exciting and all. It was just kind of doing something different, kind of, since you've just done about 6.2 miles and all, just kind of get in a good spirit and all as it's ending. Like, the wife was a little tired, so it was kind of time to amuse her, and a little bit was caught on television, me doing that.
So when you feel pumped up and happy that you finished race, your first reaction is to skip to my loop.
I do skipping, and when I get to the finish line, I do a big jump over the finish line.
No, so you skip at all races?
Not at all races, when it's kind of like light in the mood and everybody's tired. It's like, come on, this ain't so bad. And you just start skipping and all. You can actually get some decent speed doing that. Of course, when you stop, you lose all your cardio right there. But
well, maybe you're onto something. We, a long time ago, we had the fastest backwards miler on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever thought about skipping the entire race next time?
I don't know about a 6.2. I mean,
could you skip a 5K?
5K? It would have. I
feel like this ends in some horrific ACL injury. Like,
yeah. I don't feel I could do it, at least on that race, because Atlanta road races are incredibly hilly. So trying to skip up a hill after you've done about 4 miles. Not the best idea. No, they literally have a hill called the cardiac hill for the race. So,
could you skip a mile?
I think I could skip a mile. I think I could easily skip a mile.
I mean, you're a god. Apparently, you should be able to skip.
Oh God!
You should be able to skip states
aside.
Right. So skipping a mile. Okay. Maybe you should record this and send it to us.
I can see if I can make that happen. All right.
But I would love you to do it like in a crowded area where people just look at you like you're insane.
I had to figure out the perfect spot, because in order to get it recorded,
I think skipping on the murder trail is a good idea.
That might not be bad. I mean, that's pretty flat. That'd be really easy to kind of do a mile on that one.
When I see someone skipping on the murder trail, I automatically assume they're the murderer.
You think so?
Yeah, they're just so happy. They're like, la, 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 killing.
I'm going to have to look up the article to see if that guy did that. I don't know.
I don't know, man. Well, I'm glad you got your minute of fame, and you skipped your way to the finish line.
And I was on camera holding a PBR as I was running too. Well,
keep it classy, man.
Yeah, well,
nothing wrong with a PBR after a hot race.
No, I had I think I had 3 beers during the race. First, some guys were handing out different cans, so I grabbed a Busch Light since I never put that on untapped, so I could check in a new beer. Got to catch
Busch Light. Busch Light was my college beer. That was what we drank. Well, there was a place down the street that would serve minors, and that was, they always had 30 packs of Busch Light. And then, like, the fall would come, and they'd release the camo cans.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beer of Ramapo College in New Jersey back in the day.
Oh, I was a Red Dog guy.
Red Dog. I wonder if that's still around. I haven't seen that in a long time.
If we think we've had conversations on it, it's apparently still out there. I don't think it's that easy. I haven't seen it in stores in God knows when, but it's apparently still in production.
You watch. It'll pop up in some hipster bars in Brooklyn and be the big the big thing drinking Red Dog.
All these poets are going outside in 100-degree weather just sipping on Red Dogs and all as they...
yeah. We actually called Busch Light's BL smoothies back in the day. That's what we referred to them as.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Now, when you have 3 beers, like, do you feel it at all when you're racing? Or are you like... I feel like I could have one.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe definitely one at the finish line. That's a different story. But like during, I feel like it would be a little bit difficult.
I mean, I would probably say when I say I had three beers, I had three beers handed to me. I probably got about two or three sips in any one of the three, so probably equated to one.
You didn't like stone cold them and like pour them down your throat.
Because they were all kind of early in the race, so it's like one of those, like, if I stone cold it, then I gotta like run all day and beer soaked clothing and like I said, it wasn't.
That's
like,
not a good look for God either.
No. The gods are more into the wine thing, for what I see in those like mythical pictures.
Yeah,
and stuff
out of like
that.
A big like horn or something like that.
Yeah, you don't like go over to like Israel and see like some of the prophets just chugging PBRs. So you know, I got to keep it classy.
Not yet. Well, yeah. That's good. What else you got, Mike?
Well, Scott, did you hear about the woman arrested at the Tour de France?
I did not.
So basically what happened was they were on stage one of the race, and a lot of people don't know this. In very narrow roads, you have like thousands upon thousands of cyclists there. She had a cardboard sign that basically said, "Hi, Grandma, Grandpa," something like that, okay, in their native language.
Probably French.
She was German. Get to that part. But what happened is she had this cardboard sign, and she wanted to make extra sure she got on TV. She must have saw me and said, "I want to be like that." But in any case, as she was leaning towards try to get into the camera view, her cardboard sign clipped a bicyclist and literally took down about 300 bicyclists in the first stage of the Tour de France.
And they arrested her?
Yeah, what basically happened was it happened, all the carnage happened, like, and she took out some like prime like contenders by doing this.
Yeah.
And she like flew the country. She apparently got on a flight, went back to Germany,
wow,
her native country, and I guess they found her or something to that extent, and she was brought back to France to, you know, basically adhere to what she did.
Now, what kind of like fines or trouble you look at? Like, was it an accident? Like, was it a clear accident, or was she just a complete buffoon and like in the middle of the race?
It was an accident, but it was still stupid. So basically, imagine, if you will, this is like the edge of the road. My microphone, uh-huh, right here.
Oh, you actually you plugged that in?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
She's like literally leaning the sign, like she would be right here and the sign would be coming out to like right here.
Yeah.
And when you have thousands of people bicycling on a tiny road, you were basically asking for it. And like I said, it clipped one bicyclist and there was nowhere for anybody to go. And there was literally like a 10-15 minute stretch where it was just like all the major teams were just like stopping the car, diving to get a new bike, trying to pick up their bicyclist.
Now, what do they charge her with?
I don't know the exact, but I think it's just basically, you know, if anything, it was leaving the scene of a crime. Because, like I said, they literally wanted to talk to her and she left the country.
I kind of feel bad for her. I kind of feel like, I mean, saying "Hi, Grandma," or whatever the sign was, it seems pretty innocent, and maybe she just made it. This is like the equivalent of like someone when they catch a fly ball when it's not a home run. You know what I mean? Like, but obviously maybe a little bit on a bigger scale. But like the people who do that never really like mean to interrupt the game. At least most of them,
like Barkman, he didn't mean to, and Jeffrey Mayer,
right,
the one you were talking about.
Yeah, but like, I don't think she deserves like this this like search for her, you know, across countries and whatnot. Seems a little extreme to me.
Well, so there were injuries caused by the accident. That could be the other reason why there were criminal charges put against her.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, I almost feel bad for the girl.
Well, in the spirit of this story, I have, as we kind of talked about, like Bartman and Jeffrey Mayer, who interfered in baseball games, I actually have three different people who are kind of famous as fans that kind of got involved in sports.
Ah.
I have a very, one that's kind of, is very cute, all the stuff he did. I got one that's kind of cute, but kind of scummy. And I got pure scum.
All right. From a little scum rating here.
Yeah.
Do you have the, is one of them the guy that parachuted into Shea Stadium?
No.
That guy was pretty cool. He had like a Let's Go Mets sign on the parachute and landed in like center field. pretty sweet.
Did he at least catch the fly ball to coming at him?
No, that's why they lost. Duh.
So, Scott, where should I start?
We got to start at the nicest and work our way up to scum.
Okay. That sounds good.
I hope the last guy's like, this guy thought he was a god. He woke up.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Do you know the name Barry Breamon, Scott?
Yeah, it's Barry Bonds' second brother.
I think you're thinking something else and all, but this guy was a kind of like a marketing executive, a former disc jockey, but he was kind of known in the 70s for sneaking in to different games.
Okay.
And just kind of cutely trying to see if anybody notices he's on there. So let me go through a couple of his stunts that he did.
All right.
In 1979, Breamon donned a Kansas City Kings uniform and got onto the floor during the pregame warmups of the NBA All-Star game at the Pontiac Silverdome.
I also just learned that the Kings were ever in Cincinnati, Kansas City.
Yep, before they went to Sacramento. He was ousted by All-Star Otis Birdsong, mainly because Birdsong played for Kansas City and said, "You're on my team and I don't even know who you are."
I kind of like it. Like the ingenuity, if you will.
Yeah, this is a few things. He did it a second time in 1981 for the All-Star game at Richfield Coliseum wearing a Rockets jersey. Then he actually dressed up in an official's jacket and stood with the real officials during the national anthem of Game 5 of the NBA Finals, which ironically was with the Rockets in there.
This guy's my hero. I just picture him standing there as a referee. It's awesome.
But that's not it, Scott. He also dressed up to be a part of the Major League Baseball All-Star game in 79. He dressed up as an umpire for the 1980 World Series game and walked out to home plate with the other umpires. In 1986, he repeated his deal of wearing a Mets uniform and shagging flies at the All-Star game at the Houston Astrodome, only to get berated by Tommy Lasorda before he was escorted out of the building.
Now, is he taking an arrest every time he does this? Like, he must have built up a pretty decent track record.
Yeah, he's got a pretty decent one, because I'm not even halfway done. In 79, he dressed up as a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader and jumped onto the field during a Cowboys-Redskins game, only to get tackled and handcuffed.
My first question is this guy alive? Because I would love to interview this dude.
Sadly, no. Because I would, as I was researching this, I would have definitely been contacting him. But he also posed as a line judge, as a referee during the Super Bowl 15, and a callback to one of our former guests, he dressed as the San Diego Chicken, but was stopped trying to get into Super Bowl 16 at the Pontiac Silverdome. He's also he's gone into the U.S. Open, the golf tournament, and done practice rounds with some of the legends, but he basically saying it was the easiest thing to sneak on because nobody knows any golfers.
This guy might be my hero. This guy is fantastic.
He was awesome. He retired from gate crashing in 2005, basically noting, you've heard of taser guns, you've heard of 9/11. They don't ask questions anymore. Sadly, he died of cancer about 10 years ago.
Or did he? That would be the ultimate Andy Kaufman-esque move for him.
He could rebuild. Amazing.
He could rebuild his whole crashing career by fake dying, so he's not looked for.
That would be like the ending of Loki, just him like showing up at the end. So very cute stories right there, right, Scott?
I liked it.
Oh, all right. So
middle scum.
Middle scum. We are going to talk about L.W. Wright, and we're talking about my Spart. NASCAR. Now, before I go into the story, you do know the story of D.B. Cooper, right?
The name sounds familiar. Just refresh me real quick.
D.B. Cooper was a famous person who got onto a plane, said he had a bomb, collected a ton of money on it, apparently jumped out of the plane, and there had been no sign of him since. If you want to learn more, go to the American Loser podcast. They just did an episode on him.
If you want to learn more, go to dbcooper.com. His merch is amazing.
If you want to learn more, go to that DVD store in Bristol, Pennsylvania. And you can return that DVD. But Scott, L.W. Wright is known as the D.B. Cooper of NASCAR. See, back in 1982, he started contacting newspapers as he was declaring that he was going to join the ranks of NASCAR. He was telling people, announcing that he had sponsorship from big names such as Merle Haggard and T.G. Shepard, who were going to support this team. He's been telling everybody he did about 43 national races, and he was moving up to NASCAR. So he was trying to get some juice flowing for his deal.
I like it. Okay.
Yeah. So he approached some people from a NASCAR base, Nashville base space age marketing to assist him in the purchasing equipment. So he needed $30,000 for a car. He needed about $7,500 for a truck and expenses. And he even bought a car from a legend of NASCAR, Sterling Marlin. But Marlin kind of questioned the gentleman about some of the things he was about, not knowing about. And so he actually went to a race in Nashville to be his crew chief. Now, a lot of people were starting to question some things about Mr. Wright. For starters, as newspapers started to contact some of these country music stars about the sponsorship, they basically said they knew nothing about him. As they were starting to look into some of the races they did, nobody could find any kind of numbers on how he finished in races or him even being in other races or whatsoever. But one of the other things was he was asking Sterling Marlin some weird questions, stuff like, you know, how to shift and where to go on the track and something like that. But Scott, he got into the race. Before qualifying in practice, he wrecked his car, but they could fix it. He got in the race. He ran 13 laps.
Wait, NASCAR. So he had a whole team that could like fix his car up and everything too?
He had some people there with checks that he gave out to help him with the car. He finished 39th after completing 13 laps. But he
was that last place?
Next to last.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, he was basically taken off the track for going too slow. He received $1,545 prize money, no points. He showed up to the next week in Nashville, he showed up to the next race to try to qualify. Unfortunately, he couldn't qualify. But after the second race, a lot of the checks he was giving out
bounced. Yeah.
Nonstop. Huh. So NASCAR arranged for arrest warrants to basically get Mr. Wright, but Mr. Wright was never found. There was no history. Nobody knew where he was from. Nobody knew anything about it. He basically lied about everything. He conned money. And technically, he goes in history as a NASCAR racer, Scott.
What year was this?
This was back in 1982.
I feel like this was like in the more hillbilly NASCAR days. Like, you know, like where it was like, you know, maybe a little bit more loose, because there's no way ever they can just get some mystery car on the track these days.
I would say that era would be kind of half and half, because 79 was around the year NASCAR started growing to be like a national sport, but it still had the roots of like guys had open face helmets, guys were smoking during races, so... And more importantly, there weren't that good of like databases keeping track of, right, is there a LW Wright somewhere? So
that's hysterical.
It's kind of cute that a fan found his way onto the track, but he kind of screwed people out of money and almost wrecked a guy's car on it. So that's why I give him the halfway mark, Scott.
Yeah, I give him an A for effort, though. Jeez. Like, like, yeah, the other guy just had to worry about himself. This guy brought a whole team and a car. Amazing.
All right. Are you ready for Pure Scum?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm always ready. I do it. We do it once a week.
Yeah. Scott, Pure Scum would be Cornelius Neil Horan. Are you familiar with this gentleman?
No, not familiar with Mr. Cornelius.
Well, he's sometimes referred to as the Grand Prix Priest or the Dancing Priest. He was a priest, but he basically got kicked out of the priesthood. In 2004, he was found not guilty of indecent assault against a 7-year-old girl, though he did admit he was naked while the girl tickled him, and while they played hide-and-seek during the court case, he also claimed to own only one pair of tight-fitting green satin underpants that have never been washed, as he needs to be always be ready for use. At one point, Horan produced the pants from his pocket to show the jury. Somehow they found him not guilty. I don't know how that happens. But
okay.
Yeah, but let's talk about how he's involved in sports. So in 2003, Horan ran across the track at Formula One's British Grand Prix at Silverstone Circuit, wearing an orange kilt and waving a religious banner which stated, "Read the Bible is always right." His protest took place on the 200-mile-per-hour hangar straight. Several drivers had to swerve to avoid him, and the safety car had to be deployed to protect him from other competitors. Horan was tackled by the track marshal, who removed him from the track before he was arrested. He was charged and pled guilty to aggravated trespassing and sentenced to 2 months imprisonment. You figured that would be the end of our story, but no, he's got some more. He attempted to cause an event at the Epsom Derby, which is a horse race. Horan was spotted by police and shoved to the ground moments before they believed he was about to run in front of the horses. He was later released without charges, although police did circulate information about Horan to other sporting events. Apparently, people did not keep an eye on that, which comes to the biggest scummery, the 2004 Summer Olympics. Basically, what happened here, Scott, was the leader of the race was a Brazilian, Vanderlei de Lima, who was leading the race into the crowds along the course. Yeah, I believe he had like a 48-second lead when Horan came out of the crowd, grabbed him, and tackled him into the crowd. He was later released. He was able to get let go. He lost 20 seconds of his 48-second lead, but he was clearly injured. Hence, he lost the lead, he lost the gold, and had to settle for a bronze.
Jeez. Wow. Is this guy, what ended up happening to this guy?
He's still around. He tried other things, like in the 2006 World Cup, he was arrested by German police before he could stage a planned protest. He had written to Angela Merkel, informing them that he planned to dance a peace jig outside the stadium in Berlin. He told the kingdom he would carry protesters, declaring Adolf Hitler was a great leader who was following the word of Christ.
Yeah, you know who else thought they were a god?
No, not the same. You know, you got me up here. He's the scum god right there.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. That's pretty bad. I could even take all the sports stuff out of it, but the little girl in the underpants thing right away is that's the scumbag part.
Yeah, probably not the best lead in to make you make a decision. I probably should have said the other stories where you might go, he's not bad. Maybe I would hang out with him. Maybe we can get him on the podcast. Okay, Scott, just one more thing.
He did this one little thing. All right, well.
Tiny thing.
All right. I guess there's a lot of I don't mind the people like sneaking into things. I think that's hysterical, but once you start like disrupting the whole sport, that's a whole other level.
Tackling a guy who's about to get a gold medal, probably not the best thing to do.
Yeah. All right, Mike, another week in the books. Anything to promote before we roll on out of here?
Yeah, so Sam Calagione and Dogfish are doing this video promotion where they're kind of working with the Nature's Conservancy. Sam and his wife is basically doing a road tour from Miami to Maine and working with some people, learning some stuff about conserving things like our waters and items like that. And they're putting out videos. So if you go to dogfish.com/mothernature, you can watch all the excitement he's having on his road trip. As a side note, as a little giveaway that they're doing, if you use the Untapped app and you check in a Dogfish Brewery beer between now and July 31st, 2021, you will get the Dogfish badge and you will also be entered to win 2 mountain bikes.
Pretty cool. And for those of you who don't know, episode 347, so just about 20 episodes ago, we had Sam Calagione from Dogfish on, who was one of the guys I always wanted to talk to. So it was a really cool interview, and they've sent us some stuff along the way, and always supporting our friends there at Dogfish. Mike is drinking a Dogfish Lemon Quest, which is the non-alcoholic. I opted for the Dogfish Hazy O, which we had with Sam during the interview. So
all right, so we're gonna go on Untapped, we're gonna check it in, and then it could be Mountain Bike Mike. I don't know what to tell you.
Mountain Bike Mike, God Mike, Pilgrim Mike, the head of the rebellions. It doesn't end. I will promote one of my favorite comics in New Jersey, very funny comic from Last Comic Standing. Mike Gaffney, I've used him for a bazillion shows along the way and worked with him a million times. He just released, he just got a dry bar comedy special called Dummy Magnet. So it's a half hour special. It's hysterical. Mike is hysterical, and the guy absolutely deserves everything that he gets. So go check it out. Go to Dry Bar Comedy. I think it's .vhxtv, but just type in Dry Bar Comedy. Mike Gaffney, Dummy Magnet is the name of the episode, of the special. So go check him out. Other than that, guys, I want to thank all the people that have been interacting lately, the Fantuans. And
I'd like to thank all the actors, Scott. Yeah, every single one.
All right, I'll start. Robert De Niro, go.
George Clooney.
Brad Pitt.
Matthew Perry.
And I want to thank Charlie Hume, of Foghat. What an honor to have someone from a band that's been doing it this long and that recognizable on our little podcast here. So thank you guys. Keep the interaction up. Keep following. Keep sharing. Other than that, guys, life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.
I was there in the beginning. and I'll be there when you get to the end. I'm all-seeing, all-knowing, almighty, ever-showing, for I am God.
You know this is getting creepy, right?